Oh, that's right. We are here with a live Meet Me at the Diner today with Eric Williams. You know Eric, he is retired as a chief park ranger historian for the 96 National Historic Site and is also doing a lot of reenactments and is particularly interested in World War II reenactments of his dad was in the U.S. Airborne. He was in the 17th Airborne Division, and he does medic reenactments, and I am so pleased to have Eric here. It's always good to sit down and see you. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm very well, and it's good to be here. Thank you.
Yes, and for those of you that go and check out the video that will be posted on YouTube, you will have a treat because you will see Eric dressed in full World War II garb, and he even has the medic helmet here with us, and if you look on Facebook, you'll see me sporting the helmet. God, Eric, how much does this helmet weigh? I mean, it's very heavy.
Yeah, that's got to weigh about 3 or 4 pounds at least.
God, I think it's about 20. Feels that way anyways, but this is what they actually wore during World War II. So what made you get interested in World War II specifically? Because you used to do reenactments, or do you still do them of the Civil War and out there at 96 Historic Park?
Yeah, I've been a reenactor for years, so about 35 years, and I've done Revolutionary War reenacting and currently do a surgeon with the Revolutionary War time period and have some instruments with them. I kind of like the medical theme, as you can tell from here today, too, but... But my dad was in World War II, and he didn't talk much about it like a lot of veterans that saw combat. They don't talk a lot about it. Some will, but most won't.
Right.
But I was just always proud of his service, and I liked World War II history, and I liked the cause the Allies were involved in and the clear-cut efforts of the war and good, the bad, the good guys, the bad guys. And of course, you know, as growing up in the late 50s and then 60s, all little boys played Army because their dads had come back from service, and they were proud of that, and we rode our bicycles, pretended they were airplanes, and we'd hide in the woods and shoot and have battles, and so I don't know, I'm going back to a second childhood. I'm past the shooting part now, but I guess I talk pretty well, so I'm reverting back to talking about this rather than running and shooting.
There you go. It's kind of difficult. Yeah. But things sure were different in the way they fought war back then than World War II, World War I, even the Korean War, over the way they fight wars today. I mean, we've got so many drones and so many things, but there still is that physical contact. There still is that closeness that comes down in war. And I know one of the things that you were telling me right before we went on the air was about your dad was like 18 years old, and he had been training. Now, he was in the 17th Airborne Division. I don't think that they really thought that this was going to be something that they were going to see combat. They didn't have any real experience when they went into the war, did they?
No, they were just fresh out of school and volunteered and went into training, and he wanted to volunteer to be an airborne soldier. And of course, airborne troops are in a way kind of like the SEALs of today. Probably not all the training in the water that the SEALs do, and probably not quite as much as they do today, but it was rigorous, mentally and physically, and they really put you through it. I mean, there was a 5-mile run before breakfast in airborne training.
I mean, you didn't get to eat something first to fuel that engine?
No, you had to go, and those guys were lean and mean, as they say, but they were an elite Corps of troops, the airborne troops, were and had to be because of the nature of their job, what they were trained for.
Now, you told me they went over to England or to train. Is that where they went?
They got part of their training in the U.S. at Camp Forest, Tennessee, on maneuvers in Camp Forest, Tennessee in 1944. And then they've left from Camp Miles Standish in Boston and on a troop ship shipped over to England. I received more training there, and by that time it was late summer, early fall of 1944, and the Germans were being pushed back toward Germany because Normandy, of course, had happened in June of 44.
Right.
But the Battle of the Bulge occurred, and that was the last major effort by the German army to push through the Allied lines in Belgium and try to make a breakout of that strong Allied line in Belgium. So the 17th Airborne was in reserve in England. Well, in December of 1944, when the Battle of the Bulge occurred and the Americans were being pushed back, the 17th was called into action, and they were flown overnight from England to France, to Flemish France. And from there, they were trucked into Belgium and right into combat. So they didn't drop into combat. They were trucked into combat that quickly to get them in. So they fought as infantry, but their one drop came later on in March of 45 in across the Rhine River in Germany.
And these, of course, were young, impressionable guys.
Absolutely.
I mean, 18, 19, maybe 20 years of age. You know, can you imagine just what had to be going through their minds as they were in this situation?
Well, it's hard to imagine because I'm not a veteran. I'm not. I love veterans, love, as you say, the World War II history. You read a lot, you talk to veterans, and of course, doing living history like I do, whether it's Revolutionary War or World War II, I like to hear firsthand accounts. What did they feel? What did they sense when they were in combat, when they were about to enter combat? And it runs a whole menagerie, but a lot of fear. Oftentimes when airborne troops were being flown into combat on the C-47 airplanes during World War II, they would get sick. They'd throw up on the plane just because of air sickness, because of fear.
Nerves.
Nerves, absolutely. Yeah. Nerves, yeah. Sure. A lot of them, you know, would occasionally would freeze up and couldn't jump.
Because it'd be pushed.
It had to be pushed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happened, I won't say frequently, but occasionally.
Well, you can understand
training,
that, yeah.
Absolutely. In training, when that happened, they would take that soldier and usually take him out of training. Because they didn't want that fear to spread to the other soldiers. And it's not a natural thing to jump from an airplane.
It's not a natural thing?
They had to overcome that fear.
Absolutely. Wow. Well, we are going to be talking about some of the medic-type things that were used back in World War II. And we are here with Eric Williams. And I am so pleased to be able to bring this show to you today. You know, last Friday we had a whole salute to our veterans. And, of course, one of the things that was going on last week was honor flights up to Washington, D.C. Eric happened to be on the ground right up there at Greenville-Spartanburg Airport. He's going to tell us some about the honor flights. We're going to talk more about what happened in World War II and see if we can get a real feel for it. Hey, if you've got a question for us, don't hesitate to call us, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We're going to hear a word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Sunday, Monday, happy days.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. Saturday, what a day. Rock and roll with you. This day is our demand.
Oh, that's right. And we are back here at Sharp Facets Gallery on the 72 Bypass. We're having an excellent conversation with Eric Williams. He, of course, is a retired chief park ranger historian from the 96th National Historic Site, which is how I got to know Eric. And one of the things I always enjoyed, Eric, was the reenactments that you had over there. And, of course, they continue to expand and do a great job over there at the 96th Historic Site. Just to say a few words about the historic site over there, it is amazing that right here in 96 we have such a super area. Isn't it?
It is, and a lot of people don't realize it's a National Park Service area. You know,
right.
There are less than 400 national parks. nationwide in all 50 states. And we're so fortunate to have this one here.
Yes. And that's what I was saying. You know, and a lot of people don't even realize it is a National Historic Site. So make sure you check that one out. But we were talking to Eric about World War II. His dad was in the 17th Airborne Division, and although Eric was not in, is not a veteran, he, I guess you could say you were always fascinated by what they went through and how they did. And one of the things that you had told me before you came on the air, that your dad never spoke much about it, but you did tell me that your dad did say something about marching, and they had first gotten on the ground. And what was one of the first things that they saw?
Yeah, they were flown to France right at the outbreak of the Battle of the Bulge. And they were marching, getting ready to go into, you know, to meet the Germans. And where a tank had rolled through previously, there was a U.S. soldier who had been, you know, rolled over by a tank. And Dad said he looked like a pancake man, just, you know, pressed into the mud and dirt, so flattened. So, you know, for 18, 19-year-old kid to see that, I mean, you know, you're green as can be in battle. You're just getting ready to go in, and that's the first thing you see. And it just, it's wrenching, really, to think about what those young men saw and what they went through.
Absolutely. So that's to see that for a first image. Now, one of the other things you said, your dad never talked about it much, but you were talking about a gray, overcast day like today. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we lived in Asheville, and of course it snows more frequently up there. There was a church about 200 yards away with a tall steeple, and you could see it from the kitchen window. And I was in grade school then. Dad was a teacher; he taught 36 years. But we were both out of school that day. They called off school, and I happened to walk in the kitchen, and total silence in there. But Dad was standing at the kitchen sink, looking over toward the church steeple out the window. I was curious as a kid, probably 10, 11 years old, and I said, "Dad, what's going on? What are you looking at?" And he never looked at me. His eyes stayed focused on the church steeple, and he said that he said snipers. He said there are always German snipers in church steeples. He said we had to call in tanks to blast away the church steeples. Snipers put a lot of fear into those soldiers, and of course we had our own snipers as well, but they could take lives, and you never knew where it was coming from, but usually a high place like a steeple was a good guess. So, you know, it was I think back on that now, that's been 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think back on that, and it's kind of wrenching to me, and in fact, I get a little emotional thinking about that sometimes. And in his mind, he never talked much about it. He never liked snow very much, Ann.
Mm-hmm.
And because a lot of those guys they got frostbite, his feet were always sensitive all his life. He had to have just the right kind of shoes to wear because of that, getting you know, frostbite in Belgium and Germany in that awful winter of 1944-45.
You know, these are things we don't even think about. You know, they're the little things, though, that our veterans have dealt with, and whether it's the Vietnam War and things coming back from that, or World War II, or Korean War vets, there are things that they dealt with. But the very fact that that was just that moment, and I think so many veterans, from what I've seen, there can be something that, whether it's on TV, on TV or whether it's in a movie, or maybe it's just something that a food that they eat or are thinking about eating, it brings back a lot of memories.
Well, absolutely, can trigger memories from that earlier time, and it can come back suddenly, you know, upon them.
Yeah. So those are the things that you think about, and as you look back on our veterans, they've done such wonderful things for us. You know, one of the things that I didn't realize in today's Army, the military is made up of 1% of our population, just 1%, which merely makes, and in the South, though, I understand, we have a lot more veterans. I think our area has a lot more invested in wars or in the military than other parts of the country. I found that fascinating, too, Eric.
I've heard that as well, and South Carolina in particular has a lot of veterans, you know, from the wars. That's interesting.
It is, and I guess it goes to our passion for our country, right?
Well, I think so.
I think so, yeah.
Absolutely.
It's good to live in the South where we're passionate.
It is.
Absolutely.
It is. Yes.
So we're going to be talking about why did you get involved? Because of your dad? Is that why you decided to get involved
in
that?
In a way, but I've been reenacting during the Revolutionary War period for, as I say, about 35 years. And for a lot of that time, I just had an interest in the medicine, the 18th century ways of treating illnesses, of, you know, doctoring soldiers and amputation instruments, that sort of thing. So when I began to get interested in the World War II, I thought, well, I have that thread of interest already there about the medicine. So and Dad was a medic. I'm not trying to be my dad. I'm not trying to do that. But if I could bring some honor to what he did in medics, I enjoy that. So I like the medical theme.
Well, don't you think the very fact that, you know, where would they have been without the medics? And your dad really wasn't trained as a medic. He was trained, but he didn't have a medical background.
Absolutely
in any way.
Not. No, they were not doctors, but they were specially trained. He went to medical school in Denver, Colorado, and then Spokane, Washington for a while, too, before he deployed overseas.
Mm-hmm.
But they were trained, but they were not doctors. And when people ask me when I'm at a World War II event, you know, they'll say, well, what did a medic do exactly? And you can think of it like almost they were first responders or EMS on the battlefield.
Would be an awesome responsibility, Eric.
Well, true enough, under battle conditions.
Yeah, exactly.
But almost every item I have here is more of a first aid item. The serious surgical procedures were done back behind the American lines in Army field tents by surgeons, actual Army surgeons. So a medic's job was to relieve pain, stop bleeding, patch up the soldier, and get him ready to be trucked back to the field hospital and try to save his life.
Wow. And, of course, we have all kinds of helpful things. Let's see, what was one of the things that you had that you wanted to talk about? The morphine?
Exactly.
We've got morphine tartos right here.
Those are reproductions.
Reproductions? I'm torn.
But I'll tell you what, those are expensive today if you find any today to get original ones. But these were invented by the Squibb Corporation about the time of the war. And it was a half grain of morphine solution in there. These were meant to relieve pain quickly on the battlefield.
Wow.
And just real quick, what you do, take the plastic cap off and it's sterilized. There's a little pin that you would push down into the tube to release the liquid.
Wow.
Then take the pin out. Toss that little pin away, and then you're left with about a half-inch needle. So this would be to give a shot, either upper arm or thigh, according to where the wound is for the soldier. Squeeze with your thumb and forefinger, the little tiny tube, squeeze this solution through the needle into the soldier,
wow.
And in a few minutes he'll be relieved of some pain. And when you have a serious battlefield wound and the man is, you know, screaming, yelling on the battlefield, that you want to get his pain relieved.
Absolutely.
But the medic was, as I say, was a first responder, and your clarion call would be medic, medic, you know, in the midst of battle. And if the soldier couldn't call you, that was wounded, someone would call. And then unarmed, you're supposed to be unarmed, the medics were, because according to the Geneva Convention and nations who signed on to that, those who are identified as medics were not supposed to be armed. Now, that wasn't always the case, but most times they were not armed. So, you know, we're supposed to shoot at medics either. They're just trying to save a life.
Sure.
And there are a lot of cases, too, of U.S. soldiers assisting German soldiers after a battle, you know, in the interest of humanity.
So medics would be helping German soldiers?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it happened the opposite way, too. Germans helped American soldiers as well, so It's one of those oddities of war. You think you're trying to kill your enemy, but yet you will help preserve his life after a battle. So it's kind of a paradox in a way.
That is kind of a paradox,
mm-hmm.
when annihilation was really what you were trying to do in wars then. Now I don't think that's what we try to do, annihilate, but in that period of time, that was what we were trying to do. Very interesting.
Sure. But, yeah, the morphine syringes were great items. That was probably one.
Sounds like they'd be great items today, Eric.
Well, that was a good one. And another good one was the sulfa powders, sulfanilamide powder. This was sprinkled on an open wound. It would help to some degree to assist with coagulating the blood, to help bleeding, mainly to stop infection. There's a great scene in Private Ryan. It's kind of a wrenching scene of when one of the soldiers has a stomach just shot away, and he's really in bad shape. I don't think he makes it, if I remember right. But a couple of soldiers, have these, and they sprinkle on his wound, and you see it happening. But that was done a lot. But those were good items that a medic had to use.
Wow. And so they were trained to do this. They learned how to handle this. There's a lot more things here that we're going to be talking about. Hey, you got to stay right with us right here on WLMA 1350 AM. That's right. It is time for South Carolina News, a word from our sponsors. If you've got a question for Eric, don't hesitate to give us a call. 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
What does WLMA stand for? Well, it stands for Wow, Let's Meet Again, right here on 1350 AM, Greenwood and the Lakelands News Talk Radio Station.
Happy
day.
The art of jumping out planes.
Yes, we have.
But think about World War II, what they went through.
Yeah. It's pretty incredible.
Oh, that's right. I do believe we're back right here at Sharp Facets Gallery. I am talking with Eric Williams here today. And let me tell you, to wear one of these helmets is just unbelievable. Eric, I mean, I've just put this helmet on. If you go to watch the video, folks, you'll see me with a medic helmet on here. But this thing is so heavy. And you were telling me they actually jumped out of planes with these on, not only the medics, but all the guys jumping out?
Oh, they did, absolutely. They did. If they were jumping into combat, that was their head protection there, and it is quite heavy. There's a liner under it, and it's strapped tightly to the, they call it the shell.
Right.
The steel shell.
But it's really unbelievable what they went through to jump. And then you were telling me when they jumped out of the plane for combat now, one of the things that they had to deal with was what? You said the blowback or something from jumping?
Yeah, they call it prop wash from
there
the C-47, the cargo, and then we know them, the civilian version of as it's a DC-3, a civilian airliner used to be, but they converted them in World War II. They called them C-47s, and you can see the whole platoon of airborne troops, and when they would jump out the left side of the plane, out the cargo door, the prop wash or the turbulence from those huge propellers would just turn the airborne troops upside down and all around before they righted themselves with a parachute and floated down to the ground.
You know, we can't even think about some of the things that our troops, World War One, World War Two, what they went through, because today we see them jumping out of planes and it's all aerodynamic and all totally not perfect, but they've fixed some of the things that our guys went through back World War Two, World War One. It is amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing. It is different. Some things are similar, but a lot is different. You know, they jump out of the kind of the back of the plane now, so it's probably a safer jump altogether than it was during World War II.
Sure, and of course, some of those cargo planes even drop equipment, tanks, and everything else, don't they?
Absolutely. On TV, sometimes you're seeing like pushing tanks out, and it's just amazing to me how they can do that. Those huge transport planes, much larger than the C-47s, it is. Pretty amazing.
It is. Now, one of the things we wanted to talk about was you said that bag right there, a medic in the airborne would have just a small bag like that, and everything that they had and a lot of what you have here on the mm-hmm. table would all fit in that one bag. That's amazing.
They were specified strictly what a paratrooper medic was supposed to carry. I have the list at home, but I've assembled my gear according to that list.
Mm-hmm.
But everything you see here, bandages, morphine syringes, safety pins, emergency medical tag booklet, all these items, the surgical instruments, all would fit inside the bag and were supposed to fit in there. And the nature, of course, the airborne troops were that they already had a lot of equipment anyway. They had a spare parachute in the front at the chest and, strapped on there, but they couldn't carry a lot more than they had.
Because they were jumping out of planes.
Absolutely, jumping out of planes. Exactly. So, but the infantry soldiers, U.S. infantry soldiers, had two of these bags specified for them with even more medic gear. But the airborne troops are a little bit more streamlined for what they carried.
And you told me that quite often they would carry two, one on either side, small bags like that, the airborne would. Is that correct?
Well, the infantry soldiers were specified too. And then,
oh, okay.
Yeah, but the airborne troops were to carry one bag on the left side. But the infantry soldiers, the U.S. soldier, would have two of these on each side of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, but even what was this called? This is what we call a band-aid today. What was this called?
Adhesive strips.
Adhesive strips. And these are original. These aren't reproductions.
Yep.
Is that right?
They're out of the package. They're right 1940s vintage adhesive strips.
Now, I'll bet it takes quite a bit to put a pack like this together. I mean, to work on this and find original. I'm sure you can find reproductions, just like you were telling me that these were the... Are the bottles here, are they reproductions or?
The bottles are original. Those are like early plastic. They're like Bakelite.
Yeah.
And those are kind of hard to find today, but those were there were six types of pills specified for airborne troops to carry, and those were the types of labels indicate there. Things like headaches, even for simple.
I thought the last one was interesting, the laxative one.
Well, absolutely. Yes, that's true. Well, that
well,
happens.
Well, you know, you got to think about that, being in foxholes and being like that. You know, you could have a problem, couldn't
you? Yeah, you do, absolutely. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And yet it was a medic that was dispensing all this stuff. That's what I find totally fascinating, because you always think, well, it would just be a doctor. But these were guys that were trained, but still they were not doctors. They were not nurses. They were the medics that were trained.
That's true. They're almost like first responders on the battlefield. You know, first aid. These are all pretty much for first aid, what you see. The more serious surgery was done behind the lines by Army surgeons who were actual doctors who would actually do the operations. But the medics were kind of the unsung heroes, really, of the war, because, you know, when those young soldiers were wounded out there, a lot of them called for their mamas, and a lot of them called for medics to come up and help them.
Now, one of the things you did say was that when it was a medic that was out there, they weren't supposed to be armed, and you were saying that they would help either side, that quite often they would help either side if somebody was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
I find that that's interesting, too.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, my mom tells a story that Dad had related to her after the war. They were married in 1946, but in the occupation of Germany in the summer of 1945, the 17th Airborne was given occupation duties, of course, you know, keeping kind of law and order in the German society. But Dad and one of his medic buddies actually helped with the childbirth of a German woman. And he'd never done that before. But
He never birthed no babies.
But he did then. Yeah. And just the interest of, again, assisting, you know, humanity. And, you know, that was part of his job, and he did it.
You know, one of the stories that Jeff, actually, my husband, tells is about being in Vietnam, or maybe it was in the Philippines, and they thought if it was an American soldier, they were a doctor, and they knew how to birth those babies and this type of thing, and Jeff goes, they'd come, and he'd just go, no, not me. So, interesting stuff. But it has to be difficult to put together all these things and to find them. Original stuff, that it's interesting that it's still out there and you can find it, and it's not just in a museum.
No, absolutely. And in fact, there was, of course, for a four-year war, which World War II was, there was a lot produced. You know, 16 million men and women, and you had to, you know, the companies were contracted through the government, you know, to produce medic items or armaments or whatever. And there's a lot still around. You'd be surprised. And eBay is a great source. There are a lot of collectors.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they have excess items, and I've had friends give things to me that say, Eric, you might want to take this. I don't need this anymore. In fact, last weekend I was up in Greensboro. They had at the Guilford Courthouse National Park up there, they have a timeline event of American history, American military history, and I came as my World War II medic. But a friend of mine gave me, this is an original packet of, it's 1 ounce of absorbent cotton in kind of army drab paper here, from New Aseptic Laboratories, Columbia, South Carolina.
How about that?
So that caught my eye, and I was real glad to get that. But he said he had that stuck back, and he thought I might like it. So that's great stuff for me.
It is, and it is amazing, the whole effort. You know, the difference, I think, in World War II versus what we deal with today, World War II, the whole country was involved, wasn't it? So that's interesting.
Absolutely
that back in down there from Columbia, mm-hmm. here was something being manufactured right there in Columbia.
Absolutely,
so, yeah.
Sure.
And today it's more, it's not really a United States war that everybody is involved.
No, it's a totally different time at that time and a different mindset. And there were a few, and you pretty much say a few who opposed the war, who didn't want, like World, didn't want to think we should be in it. But mm-hmm. for the great, great majority, the country was behind it. As I said before, they knew the difference in right and wrong, the good guys and bad guys, clearly defined. And the American way of life was definitely at stake, because had Germany conquered England, then we were next. I mean, we were going to be next for sure. So we had to respond, and had to respond powerfully, and we did.
Yeah, it is amazing. And here we are today just wondering what direction our country is going to actually end up going, don't we, Eric?
Yes, we do.
We do, and we're concerned about it. Hey, when we come back, I want to spend a little time talking about Honor Flight. What a great program that is. How you've gotten involved in it, and we're going to talk a little bit about our World War II veterans. And again, if you're a World War II veteran, World War I, if there's some out there, and Korean War, Vietnam War, all veterans out there, thank you for your service. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't you go away.
Hello, blue. There's nothing can hold me when I'm
gold dust at my feet.
This year will be a simpler year, one fine gift to last a lifetime from Mother Earth with love, a diamond to light the way and create the energy to keep your love alive. Only at Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72 Greenwood, 229-6276.
Oh, that's right. We are right back here at Sharp Facets Gallery. Hey, you know, one thing I do want to tell you before we get back to talking to Eric here as to what is going on with honor flights and whatnot, I want to talk a little bit just for a second about the price of gold right now. Let me tell you, the price of gold is, I don't know, is it up, is it down? Hey, I am not really sure, but I'm going to tell you right now, I should have had this ready when we came up, but I didn't, so we're going to find out just a minute here. Price of gold, thank God for my smartphone here, folks. Price of gold is, let's double check it, yes, it is at $1,772 right now. Price of silver is at $33.94. They've gone down a little bit, but not a lot. So let me tell you what I say. If you've got gold, if you've got diamonds, if you've got silver you want to sell, come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. The reason that I say this is because you never know what way it's going to go. But right now it is trending down a little bit. So take advantage of the high price, $1,772 for gold. Gosh, what was gold back in World War II? What was it, $35 an ounce maybe?
Probably something like that.
Yeah. Up until 1965, I believe it was, gold stayed steady, and probably Jeff will come correct me on this, but gold stayed steady at about $35 an ounce, and then, of course, at that point, we actually went off the gold standard, and the price of gold started fluctuating. But $1,772. Come see us today. What makes Sharp Facets so special about buying gold is that we pay for your jewelry. So if you have diamonds in the ring, we're going to pay for that. If it's in good condition, I'm going to pay you more. If it's in scrap condition, I'm going to play you the most around. So come see us today at Sharp Facets. Got a question? Give us a call. 229-6613. Well, I had a call from Jimmy Jarvis. All World War I veterans are dead, Ann. Thanks, Jimmy. Thank you for telling me that. I appreciate it very much. And World War II veterans are dying very, very fast. And, of course, the Korean War, I understand you were a medic in Korea. And we thank you for your service, Jimmy Jarvis. In fact, we thank all of our veterans for our service. We don't, you know, on a day-to-day basis, I'm not sure it's something that crosses our mind unless we have somebody that's involved in the service. But one of the things that I heard on Veterans Day that I thought was very meaningful is, we should not just say thank you on Veterans Day. It's something we need to think about, and we need to make it easier for our veterans today to get the services that they need and should get. And that's why I am so excited about what they're doing down there at the Adjutant General's office. We had General Livingston on. They are trying to set up a one-stop shop for all of our military, particularly National Guard, although any veteran can call, to get them the services, whether they are nonprofit or government services. Isn't that terrific?
Absolutely. It's wonderful.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
And if you'd like that telephone number to give them a call, the number is 803-806-1461. That's 803-806-1461. So whether it's Wounded Warriors or a governmental service or any of these organizations that are out there to help veterans, they have all been put together. This would also be the number to call if you would like to hire veterans who are coming home. Give them a call if you've got a position open, 803-806-1461. See, I knew Jeff would come through with the price on that. Back in World War II, the price of gold was $32 an ounce.
Wow.
And silver was $1 an ounce. Today, silver is $34 an ounce. So a silver dollar literally was worth $1.
Hmm.
How about that?
Imagine that, huh?
Imagine that. And today, $1,772 on gold.
Wow.
Silver was $1 an ounce. And today, it's almost $34 an ounce. Well, one of the things that I'm very interested in, I understand you participated in an honor flight send-off here that happened last week up there in Greenville. Can you tell us a little bit about it, Eric?
Yeah, in fact, for those who might not know what honor flight is, it was beginning about 10 or 12 years ago in North Carolina. It's grown nationwide. It's an effort for one day to honor the World War II veterans who were physically able to make the trip to Washington to view their memorial up there. Of course, the memorial's pretty new. It's only been there about 7 or 8 years or so.
It's a pretty fantastic monument, I will say, the way it circles mm-hmm. around and everything. It's beautiful.
But to get the veterans to Washington to see that memorial and others up there for one day, and it has grown nationwide, and they'll typically fly about 100 or so, sometimes less, World War II veterans to Washington, and the veterans must complete a form, the application form, you know, to be selected to fly up there.
Mm-hmm.
It's no cost to them. It's for the day at no cost to the veterans. And it's corporate funding is sought by several entities to fund the trip up there. So honor flights happen from the one I'm involved with is Honor Flight Upstate. And honorflightupstate.com can be seen on the web and get information and applications from there as well. In fact, when I was up there last week, someone came up to me and said, "Hello there, buddy." And it was an old veteran, and it was former Sheriff Giles Daniel of Greenwood County, who served aboard the USS Hornet in World War II.
Wow.
And I had known him for several years through when I worked at the historic site. We'd met before, but he recognized me, and I was surprised to see him. But he had a great trip up there with Honor Flight.
That's right. And, of course, some of the sponsors for this, Verizon Wireless, Lockheed Martin, and Sphinx, they were actually sponsored last week's flight, which was last Tuesday, a week ago Tuesday. And, of course, Senator Lindsey Graham, Representative Trey Gowdy, Jeff Duncan, and Simpsonville Mayor Dennis Waldrop, and the sheriff up there, several different organizations that are all law enforcement are also involved. So that's terrific that they got involved. Now, tell us exactly why are you involved in it?
Yeah, it caught my interest from the beginning. When I first began to hear about Honor Flight years ago, when I still was working with the National Park Service, and I thought that when I retire one day, I'd love to get involved in a worthy cause like that. I can't think of anything more worthy for me to be involved in and have my interest as I do in veterans in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a contact and was invited to come up with my medic uniform on and my airborne uniform and the medic gear to come up and be able to talk with the veterans some prior to them flying that this day. And it's about 6:45 in the morning that they begin to come in there with their families and their answer the bugle
call of duty here. Yeah,
that's
okay.
Right. So I get to see them then, talk with them some, and then I usually stick around Greenville for the day, go some places, come back about 5 or 6 o'clock. Then people are starting to gather people, as in, you know, family members, interested people who want to honor the veterans. When they come back, it's one of the most special things I've ever seen, because at GSP Airport, for those that have been there, it takes place next to the baggage claim area where the escalators are. The veterans are brought one by one to the top of the escalators.
Wow.
And both escalators are actually, they come down from the top.
Sure.
They change one that comes down. Each veteran is flanked by two law enforcement officers on each side of him. And when he steps to the top and waves to the crowd just goes crazy. They wave American flags, the high school band plays marching music, you know, America the Beautiful. And those, if you could just see their expressions on their faces, the old veterans, I mean, their smiles, their grins. Some will give a crisp salute, you know, 70 years ago when they learned how to salute. And it's just one of the most fulfilling things you can imagine. And to realize, too, it's for such a great cause, and that it is a closing door, because the World War II veterans are dying at about 1,000 a day. We had 16 million veterans from World War II, U.S. veterans. Now there's about 10% left in the country. So Honor Flight is just the greatest way in the world to honor them, and it is a closing door. In a few years, it won't be happening anymore for the World War II veterans. So right now we have that opportunity, the unique opportunity to honor them, and I want to all that I'm able to.
Well, the next time you know about one of these flights, you should give us a call, and we'll make sure to put that out there. So if people would like to make the trip up there and experience this, that would be terrific, Eric.
They'd never forget it. You never forget it. It's something that'll stay with you always, and to know that you've done something to honor those guys 65, 70 years ago who were right in the thick of it and doing what they're good for their country.
Absolutely. And, of course, they have the upstate one here in Greenville. They have one in Columbia, I think,
mm-hmm.
and one down there in the lower state on the coast. Is that
right,
correct?
They do.
Yes.
In fact, I was in Greensboro last week for an event up there, a historical event. I went as my World War II medic impression. But at Triad Airport in Greensboro, they had their last honor flight.
Their last honor
flight? They had about 5,000 people there at the airport. They told me I didn't make it up there for it, but friends told me it was absolutely incredible. So many people came for the last honor flight because they've been flying for several years from that area, and apparently they've flown most of the veterans in that area now, so they're going to close down that particular honor flight. So that was done.
Well, there you go. You talk about a closing door. Yeah. There you go. Hey, I am Ann Eller. This is WLMA right here in Greenwood, South Carolina. We're going to stay here just a minute to wrap this up. Eric, I know Honor Flights is such a great organization, and I know this has meant a lot to you. Did you get to talk to any of them after they came back from their flight, when they were coming back?
Absolutely, and some are in wheelchairs. I always like to go around and just shake their hands, and they're just absolutely beaming when they come back. And I asked several of them, I said, did you enjoy your day? And it's just fantastic. Everyone's so nice to us. And I said, to one old veteran, I said, well, I said, we appreciate what you did for the country during the war. He said, as a lot of them say, it was a job to do. We had to do it, and it was something we had to do. And another veteran the other day told me after the flight, he said, you know what? He said, really, my experiences in the war shaped my life.
Absolutely.
He said, it shaped my whole life. My experiences did. And you can see that, how at such a young age, what they went through, served their country, and how it did shape their lives. So, you know, they tell you sometimes about combat they were in, little snippets that you hear from them, because you're wanting to see several, you know, before they get away after they come back from the flight. Most interesting, I love to hear their stories, and they just love the Honor Flight, and they think it's just a great program.
Well, it certainly is a great program, and it certainly is a great program that we're able to honor our World War II vets. I only hope that at some point we start honoring our Vietnam vets for all that they did for our country.
It's way, way over time for that, and I think Greenwood went a long way by getting the
wall
that heals
mm-hmm.
back in September, and I was on the honor guard on the Sunday afternoon there for it. Talked to a lot of Vietnam veterans. There were a lot of Vietnam veterans here. Afford. Some had tears in their eyes, some a lot of pride for what they had done, And one veteran, Vietnam veteran, told me for the first time in 40 years, he felt like he had been properly thanked, you know, for what he had done, and then came back to the country. So it served a great purpose getting their wall here.
Absolutely, and we can thank a lot of people for doing that, but we need to thank Kerry Bolt, our Veterans Affairs officer, because he put the ball in motion and got this thing put together. And, of course, I know today Kerry is probably bouncing off the wall over there at the old library, as that will become the new Veterans Center there, and I think that is terrific. Eric, thanks so much for bringing your medic stuff here with us today. I certainly appreciate sitting down and talking to you about medics in World War II. This was part of our veterans celebration that we did last week, and we had to take it over to this week. But thank you so much for coming out today. Absolutely.
Just one quick thing that came to mind. I encourage anyone, particularly those with families of World War II veterans, Korean War, Vietnam, any war, interview your relative, your friend, if they are willing at all, get them to talk about what they went through. Those are great stories, life-changing stories that they have, particularly World War II, when there's a sense of urgency. Write down what they tell you. And I've been doing that some with a few of my World War II friends, and just trying to get those stories recorded. That is so important, and the time is closing on the World War II veterans.
It certainly is, and I think one more point we should make, that a lot of veterans don't like to talk about, shall we say, the gory details of war, but they certainly will tell you stories about things they do want to talk about. Absolutely. I had Marion Sturkey tell me veterans only talk to veterans about some of this stuff, and we can understand that. Hey, I am Ann Eller. Eric, thanks so much for coming out and sharing with us, and it is really important to get the stories, because you want to continue those traditions to be able to tell family members after family members, because we don't want to lose these memories. They are memories. They were part of our history and part of our culture. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Thank you, Eric, for being here.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. I always enjoy sitting down and talking to you. This is WLMA right here in Greenwood. Bye-bye, everybody.